Hello, and welcome to Journal of a Medical Intuitive. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Lisa Vest, and this is episode 19, The Evolutionary Force of the Coronavirus. I got a recent transmission from my guides about the coronavirus and about the planet. They told me that Earth is in a transition, a really important transition, and right now part of the planet is moving forward and growing, and part of the planet is regressing and moving backwards. And so there's a very uneven amount of growth on the planet, kind of like if the planet were covered in hair, parts of it would have long hair and parts of it would have short hair and parts of it would be bald. And so it looks kind of crazy. And when you look at it, you can see how this is progress. You can't see how this is progress. You might not be able to see that this is progress. But if you're someone that has cancer, and you have no hair on your head at all, and then you suddenly start growing hair on just one side of your head, you would be happy and you would see this as progress. And you wouldn't say, oh, why is the other side not growing as fast as this side? No, you'd say, well, I have hair. I'm here. I finally have hair. And that's how we have to view the Earth planet, in a state of growth and uneven growth, with certain parts of the world growing quickly and other parts not growing at all. And it's okay, because one of the lessons for the planetary system right now is for humanity to unify. The globe needs to unify. People need to come together across country and language and nation and religion. People need to come together. We need to overcome our preoccupation with separation. And we have come up with so many ways to separate ourselves on the basis of gender, sexuality, nationhood, philosophy, religion, phenotype, geographical location, historical relation. And all of these ways that we've created to separate ourselves and define ourselves as separate from one another have just contributed to all the problems in the world. So they told me this coronavirus has the opportunity, it's creating this opportunity for us to come together as a planet, to come together as a planet to erase the boundaries and to help each other, regardless of these perceived boundaries and separate identities. This is the opportunity being presented to us. And it's an incredible opportunity, because if we actually take it up, it's going to transform the world. It's going to evolve the world. If we can actually begin to take care of each other, if the rich countries start taking care of the poor countries, if they start sending vaccines and doctors and hospitals and medicines and providing clean water and infrastructure for people to get better, if people start actually sharing those resources across boundaries, then the more we do that, the more we're going to recognize how valuable that is for the whole planet. You see, it's a lie that scarcity and hoarding are the key to success, but it's a lie that we have believed in for a long time. And so certain countries have robbed other countries and then hoarded what they've robbed to protect it from anyone and everyone, taking it from them and then identifying or creating a whole identity around that. So France, for example, went to the Americas and Africa and Asia and stole a lot of resources and enslaved people and extracted resources and built up wealth. And then they used it to define themselves very narrowly as French people. Then when a whole lot of those former colonials started immigrating to France from the colonies, the French became very nervous and insular and anti-immigrant and fearful that all of their stolen goods were going to be stolen from them, that these immigrants are going to come into their country and destroy their culture. So you have this kind of sentiment in many countries. France is just one example of this hoarding mentality, what they call this hoarding mentality. This way of putting up walls to protect what we have from the others, the hordes at the gate, the people who would come and take what we have. And this attitude is very prevalent in the United States, especially under Trump, where the closing of the borders, the protecting of us from the menace of the immigrant, the attitude that after the United States has gone around the world ransacking and colonizing and stealing it and stealing to build up its wealth, then it was like, oh no, we were like, oh no, people are going to come and steal our wealth. And so this insulation, this jingoism, this nationalism that rises up in countries, and this poor perception of people at the border as threats to our treasure, it happens all over. You know, Bosnia, Bangladesh, it happens in so many countries, Greece. It happens where people at the borders are perceived as a threat to what the country has. But they said this all has to change now because of COVID. COVID doesn't respect any borders. And while it's true that COVID does disproportionately affect some genetic populations more than others, it's not the case that any one country is immune. Certain countries are less susceptible by design, but even they are not immune. And even they are not immune to the global impact of the virus. So while it may be the case that in East Asia, for example, virus rates are much lower than South Asia or Africa or the Americas, it is not the case that East Asia will be immune from what happens when so many people get sick and die in other countries like India. There's no way for them to insulate themselves from the global impact. There's no way for anybody, for any country, to insulate themselves from the global impact of coronavirus. And so whether it's the Netherlands or China or Japan or the United States, none of these countries are going to be able to police their boundaries from the coronavirus. It permeates all boundaries, and it brings awareness to the fact that boundaries are not real. They're artificial boundaries we have created for our own identities. And what the coronavirus is bringing to our awareness is an evolved understanding that these identities no longer serve us. They no longer serve us, at least not in the way that we think they do. This is not to say that identities are not valuable and that we should eliminate identities. No, just that the identities are not valuable in the way that we think they are. And so one of the ways that we think identity is important is we think it allows us to be, for example, superior to other people, or it allows us to have more resources than other people, or it allows us to protect ourselves from people that we don't want to associate with, or that we think are less than us, or that we think are going to ransack our treasure. That belief about identities is false. False insularity and nationalism actually doesn't serve us. Now, a cultural pride or respect for one's ancestors, respect for one's history, a desire to preserve one's traditions, are positive aspects of identity. But fear and bigotry are negative aspects of identity. What the coronavirus does is it forces us to parse these things out, to separate the wheat from the chaff. Which aspects of our identity are actually serving us, growing us as people, as cultures, as countries, and which aspects of our identity are harming us, keeping us closed, keeping us operating at a low vibration. The fear that was sparked by the coronavirus brings awareness about fear, brings awareness about other fears. It also causes us to recognize that other fears that we have may not be as important now that we have this bigger fear. And this is the power of the coronavirus. And some will see this as very negative, but from a larger perspective, you can see this as positive. The fear and terror that coronavirus brings to the planet forces a certain amount of perspective so that old fears get reevaluated and discarded and recognized as not valuable. And this is how it is in a crisis, right? When in crisis, people's attention becomes focused on the crisis. And the shift in focus onto the crisis allows people to de-emphasize things that they thought were important prior to the crisis. Neighbors in the midst of a natural calamity, for example, will band together and forget their differences in a united front to address the natural disaster, so that the old fears regress and become less important. They become reevaluated. Oh, I don't like my neighbor because they're not like me. They're from a different ethnicity, or they go to a different church, or they have too many kids, or they're too loud, or I don't like the music they play, or, you know, whatever it is about them that I thought was a problem ceases to be a problem in the presence of a greater crisis. And so this is the powerful positive impact of a crisis of this magnitude. It causes a shift, an evolutionary shift in awareness. This shift has been happening for the last year or two, and it's a good shift. We can't see all the positive impacts of the shift yet because we're still in it. We're still dealing with the fallout, as it were, with the lost jobs, the change in our social lives, the loss of so many things that we took for granted and enjoyed, certain freedoms, freedom of movement, freedom of association, access to resources that we used to have. And now we're dealing with shortages, and we're still in the midst of this. And so we don't necessarily yet see how it's positively impacted us, but we will. They say we will with time. That sometimes it just takes time. You know, when we all left the roads in the United States, and this happened in some other countries too, but I can speak specifically to the United States where I live, we all left the roads in the early lockdown. And when that happened, we stopped flying planes, we stopped driving cars and buses, and the animals all came out, the pollution all went away, the skies cleared up, the animal populations grew, their birth rates increased, they got healthier and fatter. And we saw this incredible rebirth of the environment as a result of our withdrawal. And this was a very clear sign, a very clear example of the positive impact of coronavirus on the planet. We were able to see these positive impacts over time, and we're going to see these other positive impacts over time, but we need time. And we also need to be looking for them. We need to be looking for these positive impacts. So what are the positive impacts? A lot of families are getting closer now. Some families, you know, they got into a terrible crisis by being forced together. But a lot of families got closer. And sometimes that closeness did result in conflict, but that conflict resulted in growth. People were forced together, and they were forced to get to know each other better. They had to reevaluate and reflect on their relationships. Work has also been reevaluated. People have different ideas about work now. People are less tolerant of inhumane work environments now that they know they're not necessary. Now that we know it was possible for so many businesses to continue to operate with their workers at home, we now know that workers don't have to tolerate toxic workplaces. That's a revelation. It's a positive revelation. And some people are spinning it as a negative revelation, saying, oh, people don't want to work, or people are unwilling to go to work. We have all these teachers who won't go teach in person. Why? They don't want to die. So there are teachers who are saying, hey, I love teaching, but I'm not willing to die, right? They've drawn a line in the sand. They're reevaluating their priorities. And before the coronavirus, there were a lot of teachers who were sacrificing their lives to be teachers. They were working themselves to the bone. They were spending all of their money on school supplies. They were working really long hours. They were dealing with poor treatment by their school districts, low pay, poor benefits. And they were making all of these sacrifices, and now suddenly people are being asked to make the ultimate sacrifice. Are you willing to die to be a teacher? Well, no. Some are saying, well, no, I was willing to do just about anything else but die. And this is really raising people's awareness. People are asking themselves now, what am I willing to endure for a paycheck? Am I willing to endure abuse? Am I willing to endure health problems? Am I willing to endure humiliation and disrespect? What am I willing to endure for my paycheck? Suddenly everybody was asked, are you willing to die? Are you willing to die? And that's a very different question. Things got real extreme. And there's a way in which we can finally see them. So many people allow themselves to be killed slowly by certain environments or habits. There are people who will smoke a pack of cigarettes a day, slowly killing themselves. And then there are other people who will die by suicide, killing themselves very quickly. And these are two different paths to the same destination. But being confronted with the question, are you willing to kill yourself today? Here's a shotgun versus cigarettes, you know. Like, you were killing yourself slowly over a couple of decades with those cigarettes, but would you be willing to just kill yourself today? Well, that question causes people really to reflect. And this is a dramatic example, I know. But people then realize, okay, I guess I was killing myself slowly. And so you have this shift in consciousness around work and around quality of life and around what people are willing to give up or sacrifice. And this is a good thing. This is a very good thing. And there will be lots of other revelations like this. As we move forward, revelations about what we actually value, what we actually want in our life, and what we're willing to do for that. You know, there are some people who really value socializing and entertainment. And the question that everyone got asked during the pandemic is, are you willing to risk your life for that? And some people said yes. And some people are going to 50,000 person concerts, and some people are going to political rallies with thousands of people because their need for socializing or entertainment or political involvement or some other need they have, they decided it's worth risking their life. But you see, for the first time, we are being asked the question. And in the past, we weren't asked this question. It was like, you know, do you want to go? Do you want to do this? And no one asked you, are you willing to risk your life for it, right? And because nobody asked you, are you willing to risk your life for this? People didn't have to really confront or really question themselves about what they really valued, what they really needed. Do I really need that particular food at the grocery store? Do I really need to see those friends? Do I really need to go to this concert? Do I really need that job? We're being confronted. We're all being confronted with these questions. And that's one of the gifts of the coronavirus. We're really being forced to evaluate and reevaluate and reflect on what we value, what we need, and what we are willing to sacrifice for what we want and what we need. And this is the gift of the coronavirus, which may not be perceived as a gift by many people, but it's like that with illness, you know. As a medical intuitive, I can tell you there is always a gift to every illness. And the people who are sick do not see the gift. Because in the midst of the illness, you're not feeling the gift. You're just feeling miserable. But eventually there will come a consciousness of the gift that came from that illness. The coronavirus is like a global illness. It's a planetary illness. Eventually the planet will recognize what the gift is that has come from this illness. And we are beginning to see some of the gifts. And as time goes by, we will see more and more of the gifts. Which is not to take away from the very real suffering you see. Just because an injury or illness brings a gift does not mean it is not painful or difficult to endure. And just because we know that illness and tragedies always come with gifts doesn't mean we're not allowed to feel our feelings while we endure the tragedy or the illness. In fact, it is only by feeling our feelings and enduring the pain and suffering that we are able to eventually benefit from the gift. And I feel like I have to emphasize this point because there's a great deal of misunderstanding out there about illness. And this is another gift of the coronavirus, a shift in our consciousness about illness, what it means, what it signifies. There's a way in which coronavirus has been an equal opportunity exploiter. Although, yes, some people are more hard hit than others because of certain socioeconomic and ethnic variables, and some people are more hard hit because of bad choices, like going to gatherings without masks. But there's a way in which everybody is impacted regardless. And so the tendency to judge those who are sick is being questioned. So many people have gotten sick from this virus who did nothing wrong. We can't blame them for it. They were just living their lives and they got sick going to work to get food for their family. Around the globe, right around the globe, whole families completely wiped out. And so it's going to necessarily provoke us to become compassionate. And it's going to provoke us and push us in the direction of global community. And it's going to push us in the direction of shared understandings. We're all in this together. We are all in this together. And yes, the rich countries have lots of vaccines and the poor countries don't have vaccines. And we may imagine, oh, you know, I'm not in the same boat as that poor country. Thank God I live here. We're all vaccinated and safe, and we got our protocols, and we're all using hand sanitizer and washing our hands because we have access to water, and we can take a shower every day, and we can work at home because we all have access to computers and Wi-Fi. And in other countries, that's just not an option. They just don't have that option. People don't have the option of staying home. And in the poor countries, in the poor communities, just like the poor countries, the poor communities in the United States, people don't have that option. Everybody's working in the service sector. They have to go and work in restaurants, and they have to go and clean up after people. The occupations that the poorest people have cannot be turned into remote jobs. And so the people disproportionately hit in the United States, for example, are the people in the service sector. And the service sector is disproportionately composed of people of color and people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. And these are the communities also that are least healthy because they don't have access to quality health care or healthy food. And so, of course, they are the hardest hit. But these separations are illusions. And we can sit in a comfortable house and say, well, I'm safe. Or we can sit in a rich country and say, well, I'm safe. But it's just not true. And we can sit in our comfortable little space, separated out from other people and say, well, I'm over here and they're over there and we're different people and we're going to survive and they might not survive. But we're going to keep ourselves safe by staying over here and isolating and segregating and not letting those people come over here and mess with our stuff and infect us. But the reality is we have absolutely no control of the way the virus moves through populations. It is no respecter of persons. It is no respecter of countries. It is no respecter of religions. It is no respecter of incomes. And eventually, we're all going to learn that lesson. And that is going to be the most powerful lesson for us as a planet. When we recognize our unity, when we recognize our oneness as humanity, that is going to be the most powerful lesson, which will aid in our consciousness evolution. And that is the gift of the coronavirus. This has been Journal of a Medical Intuitive, episode 19. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Lisa Vest. If you are enjoying this podcast and you'd like more of them, please like, follow, comment, share the link, and become a Patreon subscriber. Thank you.